Okay, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me here. as I was saying to Ian Putnam before I left, I was rather nervous because I felt that, you know, of all the people here, I don't know very much cyclic cohomology, and I don't know very much geometry, so I felt a little bit like a car mechanic talking to a bunch of NASA electronic engineers about how to build a better, more efficient alternator for your car. And the more I thought about it, actually, at first I was just sort of being facetious. And the more I thought about it, the more apt I thought that was, in that, one, I'm going to give you sort of a very nuts and bolts approach of how to build this alternator, i.e., our proof of the local index theorem. And the other good part about the analogy is that I haven't a clue how an alternator works. I mean, I know what it does. You know, it takes electricity that is being generated by the movement of the engine and distributes it to various parts that the car needs, and it recharges the battery, and it does all those things. That's sort of my feeling with the local index formula. I kind of know what it does, but I don't really understand how it works, even after having a proof of it. So, any rate, huge debt to Nigel and to Colin Moscovich. In fact, since I haven't really, in any sense, looked at exactly how either Colin Moscovich did it or Nigel did it, only in talking with Alan and Adam in particular, have I learned a lot of the tricks we're using are lifted from them. And I'll try and give Nigel some of the credit where I know he's done something, or at least I've been told. But if I fail to, Nigel, don't be angry with me. I'll buy you a beer afterwards. Any rate, so. Ooh. So I'm going to start with a unital star algebra and what a spectral triple is. It's a finitely summable unbounded Fredholm module. And that's the way I like to think of it. That is, A is sitting unitally inside B of H. D is a self-adjoint unbounded operator on H with the following properties. That commutators are bounded and densely defined. In fact, we kind of usually like that A leaves the domain of D invariant. And that these traces are finite. Now, I'm not assuming my operators are invertible, even though in the B of H case you can do this without much pain. But even in that case, because I want to look at spectral flow and I want my D's to change, and so that you're not going to have any spectral flow as your D's are changing, they're all invertible. So I like to think of it that way. And the spectral dimension is the smallest p for which this holds. So there are lots of examples of dimension, at least semi-finite kind of examples of dimension exactly one whenever you have the group R acting on a C-star algebra with invariant trace. It really does, the eigenvalues really do look like they go of 1 over n when you take D inverse. All right, so that's a spectral dimension, and as usual, we're going to pair elements with K1 of the algebra. So this is distinctly in the odd case, whereas Nigel's lecture was in the even case, and I may say something about that at the very end. So we take a unitary in the algebra, and the, as again, this non-computable thing in general, the projection on the non-negative eigenspaces for D. And then this is a Fredholm operator, and the pairing is given by the index of this Fredholm operator. So that's a very nice pairing. It has some nice, very nice properties, as we know, but how computable is it is definitely something else. So another way to look at this pairing is spectral flow. And I have to thank Jerry for this. Is Jerry here? There he is, yep. A long time ago, Alan and I did, about 12 years ago, we did some stuff. And on type 2, some homotopy groups of things associated unitary groups associated with type 2 factor to infinity factor. And Jerry's student was working on type 2 spectral flow, and he said, would he be stepping on our toes? And Alan and I sort of both went, huh? Basically because we didn't know what spectral flow was, or at least I certainly didn't. At any rate, I learned from Jerry's student, Vic Pereira, about that stuff, and sort of got myself into it. At any rate, so... another way to look at this thing is that this hypothesis... I've got the wrong one. And that's why I brought my little pen. Hypothesis 2. This is what you get for writing on the plane. Since this thing is compact, 1 plus d squared inverse is compact, if you... multiply d times this, you get d squared over 1 plus d squared, which is 1 plus 1 plus d squared inverse, 1 plus a compact. So this guy is actually a parametric. That's an easy way to see it. It's Fredholm. And since that one's Fredholm, so is this one. And the difference between them is this bounded operator by axiom 1. And the straight line path between them consists of Fredholm operators, which is not hard to show, and has a well-defined spectral flow. So the path between them is the index is non-zero. You're going to have non-zero spectral flow, which means that somewhere along that path, the eigenvalues are crossing zero, which means you're having zero in the spectrum, and it's crucial. It's not a trivial problem in that case of getting rid of it. So we really want to think of these things as not necessarily being invertible. At any rate, Alan and I eventually proved a nice formula for this, which is the starting point of our derivation of the odd index theorem. So the spectral flow can be given by this integral formula where we take any n bigger than the spectral dimension and we take any C1 or piecewise C1 continuous path starting at D and ending here. And we compute this object. Again, how computable is it? That's something else to worry about. And in particular, the straight line path from one to the other is such a path. So this uses ideas, an old idea of Singer's about showing that certain things are, that this actually comes, this is the integral of some one form, which is exact and so independent of path. And so we get integrals like this. They're independent of path. They only depend on the endpoints. And for particular paths, we can actually compute, and they give us the right answer. So that sort of idea, isn't it? Now, what is this normalizing constant, which is absolutely crucial for what I'm going to do? Well, again, the 1 plus d squared comes in as a 1 plus x squared, the minus n over 2. You integrate. That's the constant. That's the way we first thought of it. When we actually did it by going from the theta summable formula that we have. We have a theta summable formula for these things as well. Going from that and deriving this formula from that, it came out that this is also the constant, the gamma function. Now, gamma function is never zero, so we don't have to worry about that. And it has a first simple pole when this is zero or when n is 1. And provided you're bigger than that, for real n bigger than 1, the thing's holomorphic out there. Now, all of this works equally well, as I say, with a certain amount of pain, if we replace B of H by any semi-finite von Neumann algebra with a fixed, faithful, normal, semi-finite trace tau instead of the usual trace. We're not assuming that the von Neumann algebra is a factor. Could even be L infinity of R with integration I mean, that's not going to give you anything interesting, but that's just to show you the wide difference of what you might get. And we prove all of our results in this generality using Breuer-Fredholm operators instead of Fredholm, and placing the ideal of compact operators by the ideal generated by the elements of finite trace. Okay. In the case of B of H, of course, that gives you the compact operators, the norm-closed ideal of operators of finite trace. Okay, now the major assumptions on spectral triple, there are two of them. First one is smoothness assumption, that all these operators A and D of A are in the intersection of the domain of delta to the N, where delta to the N is this derivation given by absolute D. Now, that it's not the same as just looking at this derivation. I mean, this is another thing. Turns out, again, since we're not assuming that our D is invertible, it's a little bit better for us to look at this replacement of the absolute value. They only differ by a bounded operator, these two things anyway, right? This function has got a point at the bottom at zero, and the other one is asymptotic to it, but bottoms out at zero with height one, value one, so they differ by a bounded function. At any rate, we assume that all of these operators are in here, and this allows us to use a small variant of the pseudo-differential calculus. Now, the second major assumption on our spectral triples, now, again, this is more or less the same sort of assumption Nigel was talking about, is what we call isolated spectral dimension. I'll define it later. It'll come up in the proof, and so I'll define it when it comes up rather than telling you now when you can forget about it. So, well, you'll forget about it anyway, but at least I would. All right. So we have this formula, which is now gone from the thing. But we have to replace that formula with another one in order to use sort of perturbation theory techniques. And we enlarge our setup with some Clifford variables. So I'm going to write all this down. And I'm not even going to tell you what the Clifford variables are, which one sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3 are. It doesn't really matter, because I'll tell you what the formula becomes in the end. So what do we have to do? We have to tensor on... Oh, shoot, I've got two of these things. All right. That's tensor on two copies of C2 onto H, and jack up our von Neumann algebra by tensoring on two copies of the 2x2 matrices. D tilde, we're just going to diagonalize D on the second two, and here's one of the Clifford variables. It's just a matrix whose self-adjoint matrix whose square is 1. So D squared, when you square it out, just gives you the 2x2 identity, and or D tilde squared. And we replace the unitary U by this self-adjoint unitary. Here's the other Clifford variable. Sigma 3 squared is also the identity. And Q squared is 1. And we need a grading operator, which we take to be sigma 2 tensor sigma 3 tensor 1, and a supertrace using the grading operator. The half is there just to give us the right answer when we look at ordinary things. So from now on, I'm going to be using, and tau tilde is the trace on this guy. The jacked up trace, in other words. And now we take a different path of D's. We take DS tilde, which is just this D tilde, to which we add just non-negative multiples S of this operator. And this has a nice property that if we look at 1 plus, we look at the same sort of thing, 1 plus this thing squared, well, we get where are we? We get this squared, but we get this squared, which is just s squared times 1. We get 1, of course, and then we get the cross terms, but the cross terms are this anti-commutator, d tilde q plus q d tilde, and an s in front of it. And the nice thing is that this is a sort of a linear term, and you can think of a bit of this is a bit like in doing Bott periodicity, you'd sort of go from general loops to polynomial loops to linear loops because they're easier to handle. Well, the previous formula we had with we were perturbing by basically u star du. Before we were looking at something like d plus t times, u d u star. When we square that guy, you get this thing squared as well. So this is nonlinear, whereas this one suddenly becomes linear. This Clifford stuff also converts ordinary commutators into anti-commutators. Okay. And also q squared being 1 makes life a lot easier to handle in the computations. All right. Where are we? We're here. Now, what did we do before? We had in our formula the derivative of this path. Well, the derivative, f derivative of this path is just q, so that's where that comes from. Okay. And to actually show that this formula works, uses our old formula plus the ideas of independence of path. We actually show that a certain long path of two variables, since you go all the way around the path, integrate gives you 0. The little bit at one end gives you 2 times the spectral flow. The little bit at this end that's going off to infinity eventually contributes nothing. And the two other bits turn out to be add up to give you the same thing. And then you get two of those, and the twos cancel. So that's where this comes from, roughly speaking. All right. So what I'm going to do is multiply this constant, put it over there. I'm going to write out what this is, and give an expression for n. So we let n equal p plus 2r. So we're thinking of r as very small here. N over 2 is p over 2 plus r. So this is just saying what n is, moving the constant to this side, and writing this out explicitly. All right. So there's our formula that we want to start messing with. So I'm pretty sure this is your idea, Nigel, to write. Here we have this is an unbounded self-adjoint operator, and we're taking it to this power. It's a function of this operator. So we're going to use Cauchy formula to write it as a function of that operator. And what's the curve we're going to use? Well, this operator also has, as it turns out, because it's actually 1 plus d tilde squared, the bottom of the spectrum is 1 at most. So if we keep our vertical line over here, the bottom of the spectrum of all these operators is over here. So they're all out here, and we think of this curve going straight up as actually going around the spectrum. And this integral actually converges in operator norm to this this is a bounded operator because we have a negative power. So it actually works. So you think, well, what has that done for you? Well, it's gotten this power which you can't handle to an inverse power, and you can use resolvents. So let me do this in 2 stages, mostly for my benefit, not for yours, I understand. So the next trick, these resolvents with this piece in are not as easy to handle as resolvents without the little extra bit. And so you use the resolvent formula. You take this resolvent, R tilde, subtract off the usual resolvent, pull them out, one on either side, and when you do, in the middle, you get the difference between this thing and that thing, and that's S times that. So it's just the usual resolvent formula, except instead of the difference of resolvents, I've moved one to the other side. Now, if you iterate this many times, and how many times depends on P, the dimension, what you get is a sum of terms that has moved the R tilde every time over to this side, and but each of these terms, here's the zeroth term, doesn't have an R tilde in it. So only one of them has an R tilde in it. All the rest of them don't have this D tilde Q anymore. And we choose how far out, how many times do we do this? Well, we take the greatest odd integer in P plus 1. Turns out that's what you need. All right. So that's, you know, I mean, it's nice, but it's all we're doing is using the resolvent formula many times. But this really has an amazing result to it. It gets rid of the RS lambdas, the R tildes completely. Is there a way to focus this guy a little better, or is that just me? Yeah, that's better. Yep. So what we're doing is we actually have this constant S to the power M that we move out in front when we stick this in for our RS tilde of lambda. We stick this big mess in. We play with the integral a bit. We're not doing very much. We're just doing trivial stuff here. So we've got this sum, and then it turns out that by the choice of this large value for M, when we integrate this bit out, it turns out that it's actually holomorphic quite far to the left. Now, this is the idea of trying to, you know, just look at, you know, you've got one critical point, the thing that Nigel was talking about, and then moving things out. Well, because of the summability, when you take higher and higher powers of this negative, this thing after all is like d squared to the minus 2, and you take a large power of that, you're eventually going to get something trace class, and you integrate it, you get trace class, it's defined for a lot of R. In fact, it's holomorphic. Now, the critical point is here, or here, and there's the picture. Here's the critical point, and this guy that we've worked out is actually holomorphic past here. Now, that's a bunch of ugly analysis that proves that it's actually holomorphic, but it does, it works, it's not that hard. At any rate, it gets rid of them. Well, it gets rid of these, but unfortunately, of course, it doesn't get rid of these guys. After all, they have to still be in here somewhere, these commutators or anti-commutators. Now, the next trick is to try and... So if you look at this thing, what have you got? You've got RS lambda, the commutator, RS lambda, the commutator, RS lambda, the commutator, da-da-da, a big mess of them. And you'd like to move all the RS lambdas out to the right. And this is the pseudo-differential calculus comes into play. And how much of this do you want to see? Let me just do so. So as I'm saying, you want to use the pseudo-differential calculus to move them out to the right. And simplifying the notation, putting A in for that, the first step is you throw an inverse and make this a plus 2. And then you notice that this thing is half of a commutator with the inverse. And here's the other half. And if I've got my arithmetic right, it's a plus there. These are just identities. You notice now that RS lambda inverse is just this guy without a minus 1 on him. And everything in there is a scalar except the d tilde squared. And so when you go to commute that with an operator, the scalar bits disappear, and all you get is the commutator with this. And so that's the content of the next one. After all, you've got this times that just gives you A times this RS lambda squared. That's the first term. And you get this RS lambda, the commutator with d squared that. Now, as Nigel had before, this notation, the commutator of d squared with an operator, you put a 1 up there in round brackets. If you do the commutator of that thing with d squared, you put up a 2 and so forth. And in fact, you can show by the pseudo-differential calculus in the setup that this thing actually equals some fixed bounded operator times this guy. It sort of has the same size as absolute d. It's not completely trivial at all. Anyway, so what's the sort of the heuristic idea that's going on here? This guy has order, you know, I mean, it has size approximately absolute d to the minus 4. And we'll eventually, if we did more and more, you have to do a lot of this, and you have to keep track of all the constants that appear. It gets fairly ugly. But these terms will eventually integrate out in lambda. We'll integrate lambda out of the picture using higher Cauchy, i.e., the derivative, Cauchy's derivative formula. And these terms are getting higher and higher negative order, and eventually, if you push them far enough out, of course, you'll be able to do the same trick you did up here and get a holomorphic function that's holomorphic in a neighborhood of this critical point. Any rate, after you do all of that, where do you get to? So we need a bunch of estimates. We keep careful track of everything that's going on. We still have the spectral flow times this constant here. Turns out, because of the Clifford variables, you can actually show that all the even ones integrate out of zero. You only have to look at the odd ones. And then, by pushing all of these guys out to the right, you're getting various powers of A. Well, commutator powers of A with d squared, and they all multiply together, and you get some very large power of the resolvent. Well, you get larger powers of the resolvent, and the bit that you throw away has a huge power of the resolvent, which makes it holomorphic, and that combines with the old holomorphic function to give you a new one. And K is the multi-index. You saw these with Nigel, and absolute K is the sum of them. CK is something I'm not writing down here. Did you write down CK? You did. You are a good man. Now, Nigel's Cauchy trick shows its worth again. Here, after all, I mean, here you've got something like where Z naught is D. You've got something like lambda minus Z naught to a power, to an inverse power. Something like 1 over lambda minus z naught to a big power, where z naught is approximately d. And if you were integrating this, d lambda, and I've got a 1 over 2 pi somewhere, except for the factorials that you need, you can integrate it out. And here's the original function of lambda. And so you're going to get some derivatives of this thing, evaluated at 1 plus d squared plus s squared. And that's what you get. Some nasty constant, which I'm not telling you about at the moment, because you don't want to see it. In fact, you don't want to see the ones I've already written. Okay, well, that gets rid of the lambda integral. And then we use Laplace transform arguments to, once we've gotten that integrated out, and we're now looking at these guys that we're integrating with respect to S, we can integrate those out using Laplace transform, and that's not terribly difficult. And I'm not going to show you any of it. But after you do that, where do you get to? Okay, so before, we only had, we've got that. We integrate out the S dependence, and we get to here. So it's a nasty constant. I should say it's not really constant, because it also depends on the varying R. But all of this stuff. and a new holomorphic function. You've thrown more stuff into the holomorphic pile, but that's okay. Now, let's notice that the thing on the left, this is a constant, a fixed constant, a number. We fixed u for all of this, and this is this thing that we know has its first it's a holomorphic function, but it has a pole at r is 1 minus p over 2. And so this thing, although initially it was only defined for r positive, in fact r for bigger than a half technically, actually has a holomorphic extension to something holomorphic in a deleted neighborhood of 1 minus p over 2. All right. Okay. Now, the nasty constant in that one, I've written down there. I haven't told you what alpha k is, but that's part of ck. It has the same, it doesn't have m plus k factorial on the top, it just has those other things on the bottom. And there's r dependence in this one. Now, if you let p plus r equal z and h be this guy, it looks like that. And remember, m is odd, so m minus 1 over 2 is an integer. So this is an integer. And you can, you know, just use a little bit of gamma functioning here because it's an integer, a positive integer, and express that the r-dependent part as, well, when you write it all out, you just get certain powers of this guy. After all, if we're going to take residues at r equals 1 minus p over 2, we're looking at these. And these just out to be the elementary symmetric functions of these numbers. H is this integer. It's different for each little m. Sorry, but there it is. Now, plugging that in, we get this honking mess of stuff. I'm tempted to draw a line there, but instead I'll do it here. Super trace of all of this stuff. All right. Now, I haven't stated the isolated spectral dimension assumption or shown you where. Here's where we need it. Again, this side has just this one pole at, simple pole at 1 minus p over 2. So this thing as a big sum has a holomorphic extension to a deleted neighborhood of that. And now we assume that each of these guys that we're writing down here, these functions on the bottom, functions of r, none of the rest of this has any value of r in it, that those things analytically continue. And we take the individual residues at this thing and call those super tau j of this. Okay. Now that's, as pointed out, there's a whole lot of stuff here. You know, for each k and each m, you've got, at any rate, it goes on and on. So that's it. And in fact, you have to, because later we're going to apply it to more than just elements like q, you want it for all of those. I'm almost done, by the way, so, gee, I feel like I should keep talking, but no one else does, so. Okay. So there's the isolated spectral dimension assumption and why it comes in. So if we take the residues of if we take the residues of both sides of this formula, the one in yellow, the residue on this side, the residue of this function is just 1 at 1 minus p over 2. We just get the spectral flow. All this other stuff is still the same constant that it was and the same sums. And H still refers to at norm of k plus m minus 1 over 2. And now we take the residues of these guys, and that just gives us that by definition. So that's just plugging in this definition. Now, unfortunately, we still have this super trace bit, but we can undo that. That's easy enough. Figure out what that is. And when you end up, you have to change your constant a little bit. That's why I've got it. I thought I had a blue, but the blue pen was dead. So that's why it's... any rate, you get this. So we're back to our original operator D, our original commutators, and now we're looking at U star U, U star U, U star U, U star U. This is starting to look like a cocycle evaluated at the thing. In fact, that is our odd local index formula in the general semi-finite case. And finally, so everything I've done up to now appears exactly in our paper on the odd local index formula. There's one more thing, is of course that somehow you want this to be pairing of, after all, except for a constant, the churn character of U at the mth spot in the BV bicomplex is, depending on whether you like it as tensors or this, it's U, U star, U, U star, U, what is it, an odd number of things, it better end with a U as well, yes, except for a constant. So you're pairing this thing with a bunch of stuff, and what is exactly happening here is that, we do show that we have we get the components of a BB cocycle. As Nigel said, you get one at the various levels. He was doing the even case, so he gets one at one. I mean, gets 0, 2, and 4. But we're doing the odd case, so we get these multilinear functionals, m plus one linear functionals, and we define them this way. Again, various constants come in. Okay, now we still have these same sigma hjs. We still have this constant alpha k that I didn't quite tell you what it was, but that doesn't matter. And now we have the m plus 1 variables in the algebra. And we're now assuming our underlying second assumption, isolated spectral dimension, is assuming that all of these things have residues. And so I've used the same symbol there. Now, in that case, in the case of these two assumptions, this actually does define a cocycle, which is not too hard to show that it actually defines a cocycle. Well, again, that's tricks with Nigel's idea of, we call them expectations with your pointy brackets, and how to move equations out far enough so that you can actually compute all the traces involved and then say, well, we have this identity between a bunch of analytic functions out here, which analytically continue, so they still satisfy the identities over here, and then we can take the residues. So you actually show that this, we do show, using Nigel's ideas completely, that that this thing is something in the BB bicomplex. It's another paper, we've now done, that's, I'm telling you about what we did in a paper called the odd version. We've finished a paper on the even version, and the problem is showing that the thing in both cases represents the churn character is not completely trivial. Thank you, Nigel, for helping us how to see how one can do that. That's the next paper. Any rate, So at least, even if at this point haven't shown anything about the fact that it is the churn character, you do get this index pairing is the spectral flow, and you get this normalization. So this thing evaluated at churn U, where that's this guy, obviously. And that gives it to you in the odd setting. The fact that it's the churn character, again, is a non-trivial fact. But what I like about this is, A, it's nuts and bolts. And I tend to understand nuts and bolts a bit more. I learned this from Mitch Baker a long time ago. I guess I'm sort of a latent mathematical physicist in this way. So it really sort of, you know, in each case you're just doing something new, and doing something new you're sort of forced into, you're starting out from a formula for the index that you believe actually works, straightforward, and then you do a bunch of stuff, and in the end you're kind of forced into this. But before you get to the end, you actually get this nice sum of holomorphic function things. It's almost a BB cocycle, modulo functions holomorphic at the critical point, without any assumptions about analytic continuation at all. Since I really do have a lot of time left, I'm not going to take it all, but let me do, I said I would say something about the even case if I did have a little time, and I do. And so what does one have to do in the even case? Well, there is no spectral flow, but of course there is either the Atiyah-Botz formula, or the newer forms are called McKean-Singer, and in the generality we used, it actually turned out to be fairly painful. In the BH case, you're just using ordinary index, and even when you're between two subspaces, which you are when you look at P, D plus P, and take the index. It looks like you're going from P to P, but P is actually, of course, because of the grading, kind of P minus. And what this thing is really doing is you're looking at something, I'll get it wrong, bear with me, it's easy. Plus goes somewhere and minus goes somewhere. Let me put the plus here, probably wrong. And you consider that as an object from P. And if that's Fred Holmes, okay. And that's fine, because these are just Hilbert's, they all look the same, and index is index, and who cares? Well, in the type 2 infinity case, you're looking at, you know, in a cut down of your algebra, P plus P minus, with your algebra in the middle. And that's fine if it's a factor, all the stuff works with only very slight modifications. But when it's not a factor, it turns out that it's quite difficult, actually, to actually show that all of the stuff that one expects holds in Breuer's Fredholm theory actually works when you're going from, you have just a type 2 algebra with a trace on it, so it could have a huge abelian center with lots of strange bits, and you're taking one bit to another bit, and you're looking at an operator that goes this way, to prove all of the usual stuff. A lot of the tricks work. You have to do them in a completely different order. It works. In the end, it works, and this thing is an index, and everything works, but it's surprisingly true. Formula like this, okay. Well, there are a couple of things that are different. One is, of course, we're no longer flow here, but we need we actually.